Hello and welcome to episode number 195 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And we have here with us, you asked for it. You demanded it. The official Peltoncast Iowa caucus expert, the famous Cousin Katie.
Thank you for having me.
1995 and Iowa caucus. Katie, please break it down for us. Imagine your holographic Will.i.am.
What are you talking? 1995?
Those are separate. Not the 1995 Iowa caucus, which did not exist because they caucused in 96 in that case. Yeah, we're going to continue recording this podcast until we get results from Iowa. We're just going to stay on until then. So, could be hours and hours.
The people really turn to the Peltoncast for that kind of information.
They absolutely do. But since we're going to need some sustenance to carry us through this extended podcast, it's time for us to crack open the beer we have this week, which I'm very excited about. I'm not that excited about it because I've already drank four of the six pack I got. But I'm excited for you to try it.
From our good friends at Fremont Brewing Company. This is the Space Danger IPA, one of quite a few new beers that Fremont is having lately.
Yeah, they're rolling this out. This is their new winter seasonal. I guess it's late winter seasonal because they have, you know, obviously their focus is on the B-bomb and that sort of thing, the barrel-aged before the new year. But after the new year, they start rolling this one out. So.
Can I just say the can design is quite something, and as someone who buys beers
strictly based on
by how the can looks, or wine by how the bottle looks, I would definitely buy this beer.
It captured my attention in Fred Meyer when I saw it, and I knew that I was like, I don't recognize this. I must buy this.
For some reason, there's a dinosaur and outer space, but I don't understand it. But
that's the danger.
Okay.
You thought that space itself was the danger,
but it's the dinosaurs.
It's the dinosaur.
It's like 60s futurism.
I see.
Is it?
Yeah.
I think it's like time travel. Oh. I don't know.
There was another new beer that Fremont unveiled also that's going to be part of their year-round selection. Are you aware of this?
Was it a new beer or was it a beer that was elevated to the year-round lineup?
Wow.
That was what I kind of thought happened.
Elevated.
Do they do like a little ceremony there?
it's very similar to the Hall of Fame.
I thought there was something else. Maybe I'm wrong about this.
They definitely did announce an addition to the year-round lineup.
Well, we can't find it
possibly
right now.
Possibly the Hazy IPA. Was the Hazy IPA seasonal previously?
No, the Sky Kraken's been around.
Okay. Well, that's also going to come up. That's also a foreshadowing something later on the pod.
Oh, hello.
Yeah.
Oh, because
Kraken.
Yeah.
What did you think it was?
can we just... Was that like a alien thing? Like Sky Kraken? Like a conspiracy theory? What did you think?
I just get so excited.
Oh, okay.
About everything.
And anytime you hear
I love when things are teased.
That's true. He does love it. And the famous Cousin Katie, you're drinking a Rainier.
That's so there true. We go. Always got to support the Rainier.
I'm also drinking a Rainier.
That's your side beer. First off, let's first toast, speaking of the Hall of Fame, to former Seahawks offensive lineman Steve Hutchinson, who was voted to the NFL Hall of Fame on Saturday with that announcement. Started his career in Seattle, was a part of the first Super Bowl team in franchise history, left in earth-scorching fashion, subsequently with the poison pill contract he signed with the Minnesota Vikings as a restricted free agent. But this time heals all wounds, and he's now back working for the organization as a scout. So congrats.
My toast is for Nate Burleson.
Oh, no. Did not make the Hall of Fame. God bless Nate Burleson.
He's in the Peltoncast Hall of Fame.
Is he?
Yeah. As of right now,
are we going to do a Peltoncast Hall of Fame? That's actually a brilliant idea, isn't it?
That's a really good idea.
We'll have to save that for after.
Nate Burleson's not going to make it. But Jermaine Kearse.
What would your categories be?
What if we did a Renton Hall of Fame? Because Nate Burleson might make the Renton Hall of Fame.
Our categories,
like. Would it be just football, or would it be all sports in
Anybody
Seattle?
Anybody can be in the Peltoncast Hall of Fame.
I think food is in the Peltoncast Hall of Fame.
Yeah, just for sure. Like a burrito, tacos, chickies, baby burrito.
Songs might be in there. It's really just anything that we're talking
Kearse, about. Jermaine Kearse, Vlade Radmanovic, and the baby burrito.
Wow, what an inaugural Hall of Fame class.
Okay, this is a thing. This has to be a thing. Pelton Cast Hall of Fame.
Let's keep that in mind. The other toast.
We're not going to be able to eat teriyaki forever.
Challenge accepted. The other toast this week to the Kansas City Chiefs for winning the Super Bowl on Sunday and for most importantly, defeating the hated rival San Francisco 49ers in what was essentially the third Seahawks 49ers game of the year, as Ben Baldwin noted on Twitter.
It kind of didn't end like it.
Not exactly.
The Seahawks would have never put a game away that easily.
They would never have won by multiple scores.
If it would have been the Seahawks, Jimmy G hits that pass, and then Russ needs to drive them down.
Or maybe the Seahawks, they wouldn't have a running back break through the line like that. But if they did, he would obviously go down before scoring to run out the clock so that you could preserve that one score victory. So before the Super Bowl, when we were on with our friends Tasteful Profanity at Beast Pod Production, you said that the worst thing that could happen for the 49ers would be them winning the Super Bowl.
I said it was the worst thing. That, are we talking about this now?
Yeah.
The Niners?
Yeah, we're talking about this.
We shouldn't save this for the very end?
No, we're going to say it. We'll talk about the Seahawks at the end.
There's Seahawks talk at the end?
There is. Where have you been? You are shocked by all these things that happened in the past week.
The Kraken?
It's a good thing we do this podcast that you learn anything that happens in Seattle sports.
I don't think I said it was the worst thing that happened. I said, in many ways, I remember the exact way that I said it, too. I said, in many ways, winning the Super Bowl is bad.
That's true. Yeah, that is what you said.
And it came out of my mouth, and then I determined that I had to defend that. But in also many ways, losing the Super Bowl is bad.
So it turns out just getting to the Super Bowl is bad for your future. Because if you win it, your players are going to get highly overpaid. You're going to be tough to retain. But if you lose it, I mean, I think it depends how you lose it. But if you have the lead and then lose it, it's going to be bad because all of a sudden people are going to start talking about your coach and your quarterback. And it turns out you may have Richard Sherman on your team and he may have a history of questioning those things after a Super Bowl loss. So
he hasn't done that though, has he?
In this case, he has not.
He actually took the blame himself. He owned up to it.
You correctly called that play where he got beat. You're not going to elaborate on this?
I correctly called everything in that game.
Oh, God.
There was literally a 2nd and 10 draw that I called just straight up.
That is true.
Tony Romo over here.
Big Felton brother Tony Romo.
This is why Katie's here.
She really, well, because she's the voice of the listener, and that's what the listener was thinking. And she said it.
I said they needed to take a deep shot against Sherman because he looked tired. And he just didn't look right at the very end of that game. It was one of those things where it's like, I was thinking of this today, actually. Aging cornerback, I wonder if there's a cumulative effect of playing against those Chiefs receivers.
Well, especially Travis Kelsey.
But the speed and the physicality of those Chiefs receivers, where it was like, I mean, the Niners played so well for 3 quarters, and part of it is probably just randomness.
And part of it is probably their pass rush wearing down, which was a consistent theme we saw, and definitely we saw in those two Seahawks 49ers game, that their pass rush was not the same factor late in the game.
But I do think that at that point, Richard Sherman, as a cornerback who's a decade into his career, he just was not able to keep up with the speed of the Chiefs at that point. And whatever, they're leaving him on an island, but they couldn't treat Richard Sherman the same as they would just in the 2nd quarter or whatever. Did it make you feel good at all to see Richard Sherman get beat like that?
Well, I didn't actually watch the game, but I heard that he got beat. Uh-huh. And
Katie Kilter programmed the Super Bowl. Yeah.
I didn't want to watch the 49ers win. That's what I was worried about. So I was just like, I'm not going to watch it. But anyways, I don't take any like joy in Sherm getting beat. I just take joy in the 49ers getting beat.
I agree with this perspective.
A little joy in Sherm getting beat.
I took no joy in it.
There's just
a little bit. Joy. I mean, maybe a little. Maybe like, just you should see it's not that easy. Like, you can't just go to another team and fix everything and it's going to be great and you're going to just waltz into getting a Super Bowl. But
you just go to the Super Bowl. That's all you do.
He also definitely talks shit about Russell Wilson. Right? Like,
yeah.
There is a bit of a factor of like, sure may have derailed a couple of seasons for the Seahawks there because he was so upset about passing from the one or whatever. And it's like, okay.
When, by the way, the Chiefs showed what you really should do at the one, which is run a single wing play from the 1940s that results in your quarterback running for
that's
a touchdown.
That's what we wanted Pete to take it back to. That is literally the only thing that Pete will have taken from this game. But also, just the long-term effects of this, of like, I think Niners fans in general were feeling generally pre-confident about Jimmy G. But like, the whole story has changed now. The Jimmy G story has changed, and the Kyle Shanahan story has changed. Where it's like, now Shanny, as many people are calling him, is the coach who's lost two double-digit leads in the only two Super Bowls that he's ever been to, right? And it's just like, Shanny can't close a game. And then Jimmy G has this one pass that he can win the game with.
I did see that.
And he sails the pass over Emmanuel Sanders' head. And it's like a Super Bowl quarterback. We were talking about this going into that drive where Jan was calling him Jimmy Garofalo. And she was like, I love that Jimmy Garofalo.
Was very upset at how so mean we were being to Jimmy Garofalo.
He is so good looking.
And it was like, not only do the Niners need to come down and score a touchdown on this drive, Jimmy G needs to come down and score a touchdown on this drive. And that just was not going to happen with him as your quarterback. Like, there is a difference between... There's a difference between Goff and Garoppolo and Russell Wilson. And it's like Russ makes that throw. And Goff and Jimmy G are system quarterbacks.
Yep. Yeah.
But do you want to see Jimmy G next year after missing that pass?
No, I don't.
And now he has no halo anymore. Like, this is a good thing.
But you think it's a good thing for Seahawks?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely the way they lost that game was very good for the Seahawks long term.
I mean, we saw the Rams miss the playoffs this year basically entirely because Jared Goff was terrible. They also, like, leveraged their entire future on this season that they didn't even make the playoffs because they're like, our window is closing. They're literally paying Jared Goff, like, $36 million next year.
You don't think there's any chance that Garoppolo gets better?
There's a chance. But I don't think this helps the chances of it.
He's 28 years old.
I guess, yeah, he is old.
He's not really that. This is not. I think there's a chance that Mahomes gets better. But I don't know if there's a chance that at this point that Garoppolo is going to get better.
Well, we can only hope that the 49ers' inability to run the ball and seal the game with first downs late causes John Lynch to go out and spend a bunch of money on a running back once again.
A fourth running back.
Third consecutive offseason.
They just got to pay the fullback more. But you couple that with having at least Arik Armstead as a free agent and like just the regression that's going to happen on their defense. It's like if I was to wage right now, I bet the Niners are not making the playoffs next year.
Wow.
I mean, I did boldly predict at the end of last year that the Rams were going to win the NFC West next year. So
I think the Rams better are about more that before they fired the playoffs Wade than the Niners are next season. There's just not in recent memory. I mean, you remember the Falcons, and granted they lost Shanny after this, but like the Falcons
Sark did nothing wrong as Falcons offensive coordinator.
They are a mess of a franchise since losing that Super Bowl lead. And you look at it and you're like, Matt Ryan has been just as good. Granted, their defense has been terrible, but it's like, what happened? Why did this happen to them? Why have they collapsed as a franchise? And it feels like it's the type of thing that happens. I was like, oh, who's the last Super Bowl loser to make the playoffs again? And it was the Patriots last year. But the Patriots are a different animal. Super Bowl losers don't do well the following season.
I don't know. Not making the playoffs is too bold for me.
Unless they have Russell Wilson's best season ever. And then they do make the playoffs but lose in the second round. I don't know. I mean, it'll be open because the other thing is the Niners were taking advantage of a third place schedule this year. I don't know if it actually conveyed that big benefits because they played Green Bay, who is actually
bad,
the second best team in the NFC North. Whereas the Rams had to play the Bears. maybe it actually wasn't that big of an advantage, but next year they get a first place schedule. The Rams get a third place schedule. So it'll be interesting. And we'll talk some more about the Seahawks and their future later. Because now it's time to go back, to take it all the way back to 1995 as we remember some years. There's no effect here. No.
I really should have a jingle.
I keep telling
NFL,
you have a
the
jingle.
NBA trade deadline is 3 days away. I don't really have time to work on that.
Do you have time to be in the lab mixing some stuff up?
I think we know where we want to start in 95. We got to start with the Mariners.
Okay, yeah, good. Because that was the only thing I actually remember about 1995.
The Mariners, so 1995 begins with the strike continuing over from 94. There's replacement players in spring training. We were way too into the replacement players in spring training. In hindsight, not a good look.
Did
but,
you guys
you know,
go to spring training for that one?
Did not go to spring training for that one. We'll remember that in 1996 was the first time I went to spring training.
You went to spring training in 96?
I did.
Did I go? What year did I go?
97.
Wow. You weren't mature enough in 96.
Yeah. Didn't you fly on a plane alone? You and David Pelton flew on a plane alone?
Yes, I was 13 at the time, almost 14, and David is a year older than me, and we traveled on
I remember being 10 and thinking that that was kind of incredible. And now I fly on planes alone almost all the time.
Wow, congrats to you. Wow, yeah. Well done. So this is actually just remembering our travel experiences. Yeah. No, so that at the end of spring training, it's ruled by Judge Sonia Sotomayor that the replacement players cannot be used by baseball. That causes the two sides to settle and end the strike. And the season begins late. I believe opening day was like April 27th off the top of my head. We should check this. The Mariners played at home.
If you get that right, I'm going to be so angry. I've never cheered less for you.
I think that's untrue. I think you've cheered less for me a lot of times. We went to the 95 season opener. Randy Johnson threw, I want to say, 6 shutout innings. Griffey homered.
What did you say? April 25th?
27th.
April 25th. Sorry.
Okay, I was 2 days off. Am I correct that Randy Johnson threw 6 shutout innings?
I don't know.
Okay, I'll have to get on Baseball Reference and look this up.
I can do that. You keep talking.
Reminisce.
I mean, well, so then Griffey, in late May, right around your birthday, injures his wrist. Colliding with the wall, trying to catch. Yeah, trying to make the Spider-Man catch. Oh, yeah. He's out for, you know, at least a couple months. And we're like, well, the season's over. I mean, the season started with pretty high hopes because we talked about
Thursday, April 27th.
Was the opener?
Yes.
Let the record show that I am fist pumping.
How did you remember that?
I don't know.
Wow.
So at this point, the season starts with pretty high expectations because the Mariners had finished the 94 season so strong, and they actually got to play at the Kingdom again because they had taken down all the ceiling tiles and it was safe for play again.
What was your description about Randy Johnson?
6 shutout innings.
6 shutout innings.
Wow. Yeah. And he was on a strict pitch count because of the fact that there was the shortened spring training.
Of course.
Yes. Uh-huh. So. Bill Risley had to come in and replace him.
Did Ayala get the save?
Yep.
Yeah. Because that was the year... That was the year Bobby Ayala fell apart and Norm Charlton came in mid-season.
If you can name who the opening day starter for the Detroit Tigers was.
I thought it was the Tigers. It was a guy who wore like number... No, maybe I'm thinking of Travis
Pyman. I've never heard of this person. I've played so much Ken Griffey baseball.
I don't know that I have
Sean Bergman.
Okay, no, I don't know that person.
You don't know him either?
We've reached the limits of my memories of 1995. And then Alex Diaz and Rich Amaral take over in center field for Ken Griffey Jr. And the Mariners actually probably pretty much fall out of the race. Like, one of my defining memories of that season was a moment. This must have, I don't know if the timing quite makes sense, but the late Dave Henderson was on KJR talking about they were talking about how the season was slip sliding away and playing that song. But the Mariners were close enough because this is now the first real year of the wild card. They were way out of it in the AL West, but close enough in the wild card that they actually made a trade at the deadline. Speaking of the NBA trade deadline, for like the first time basically in franchise history, they go out and trade Mark Newfield and Ron Valone for Andy Benes. And this is extremely exciting to us. And then lo and behold, the Mariners catch fire. Griffey comes back. Hits a game-winning home run off John Wetland in a game that we listened to in our basement. It's a very strong memory of mine. And even though they actually lose ground in the wild card race to the Yankees, they start catching up in the AL West to the Angels, who had a seemingly insurmountable lead in the West. At that point, the California Angels, like three name changes ago, passed them with a great series against the A's that we went to at least two of the three games, I think. It was like the fan appreciation night and that sort of thing. There was another game-winning home run off Dennis Eckersley in that series that was really a lot of fun. I don't know if you're checking any of this at this point.
I'm just looking at songs.
When Rick Amrall came in, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Did he do well?
He did okay.
So that really bolstered your Rich Amrall.
I mean, it didn't need bolstering at that point. Oh, okay. It was just exciting because he had been sent to the minors in 94 because he could no longer field at second base. And then they moved him to the outfield in 95 and he found his niche. So then the Mariners actually like lose two of their last three games, or maybe all three of their last three games in Texas, and the Angels rally back to force a tie in the AL West, creating a one-game playoff.
We've heard Macklemore talk about all these things. You don't need to recount the 95 Mariners season. Everybody knows. One-game playoff, everybody knows. Most importantly, though,
this
was the redemption year for Seattle sports. We talked about in 94, pretty much the bleakest moment that Seattle sports could have possibly been.
Well, I don't know when we're going to remember some years 2008, but that was pretty damn bleak. I think that was the bleakest.
But you have the Mariners season ends halfway through. Midway summer, our summer is ripped from us, right?
Correct.
The twin popsicles that we were eating all summer ripped from our hands. And then the Sonics lose the year that we think the Sonics are going to win the championship. They lose in the first round of the playoffs, right?
Which does happen again in 95.
We didn't care as much in 95.
No, because the team played in the Tacoma Dome. It was the lost season for us. Weirdly, though, the best Sonics season ever by point differential was 94-95.
So you've got the best season ever by point differential for the Sonics.
Well, more importantly, then they traded Kendall Gill for Hersey Hawkins.
It set up the 96 team that would go to the finals.
Yeah.
And the Seahawks are led to an 8-8 record. Dennis Erickson's now the coach with a young wide receiver named Joey Galloway.
We loved young Joey Galloway.
And then you have this Mariners comeback, and it's like sports are good again, right, in 1995.
I mean, you've told the story about like repeatedly going to games in the 95 season because our dad would just come home and say, hey, you want to go to the game tonight? And you'd be like, sure. And you get like...
And you had math homework to do.
I did. Very early, at least in the morning, my classes.
Zero-hour math.
They were like $7 tickets that you just went and walked up to the box office and got back in 95.
1995 was amazing.
It was maybe the best year.
It's so crazy that like... So he would ask you if you wanted to go in the middle of... like a good time in the season, and you could just walk up and get $7 tickets.
Oh, yeah. The Mariners were in the midst of a stretch of going to the playoffs.
It's so crazy.
But they hadn't gone to the playoffs yet.
The Mariners didn't have fans in 1995.
They had been in existence for 19. This was their 19th season as a franchise. They had never been to the playoffs, which granted, again, the current streak is now 19.
No. Wow, what does that tell you?
Yeah. It's really depressing.
Yeah, this is but our year.
I mean,
maybe it is.
I'm looking at the attendances here. Opening day was nowhere close to a sellout. Opening day, there were only 34,656 fans because people were still upset about the strike. The first time they had, and the Kingdom was also enormous. So the first time they had 50,000 fans the entire season was Friday, September 22nd in that homestand against
the Syracuse. The first time they came anywhere near selling out.
Yes.
Right? And that's how, so if you recall, Pelton Family Christmas Card, 1995.
Oh, yeah.
you guys cheering? Is that the? Yeah, we had that on our fridge for years to come.
During game 5 of the ALDS against the Yankees.
And your mom like made you pose cheering? It wasn't a real cheering, right?
Well, she wanted to just take a photo of us. And I demanded that it be a natural-looking picture, so we fake cheered.
Something like that.
Yeah. Oh, very, very classic meme.
So the Pelton Family Christmas Card in 1995 was you and me, Game 5 against the Yankees in the AL Division Series, like fake cheering after the double. And then I was on your refrigerator in the Tri-Cities, probably until your parents moved.
Pretty much, yep.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
What I remember from that time is I was in a math class I was in eighth grade, but I went to the high school to take a math class. and there was a kid in the
but
math
not
class.
At the first thing in the morning like I did.
I mean, it was at like 8 in the morning, not like okay. 7.
Too fucking early. Jesus Christ.
Anyways, and there's a kid in the math class who was a huge Yankees fan.
Oh, no.
And he was always like taunting the rest of us about how the Mariners, you know, sucked and the Yankees were good. So when they played, we made a class bet where if the Mariners were happened to beat the Yankees, he had to buy us a box of donuts. And we were all actually a little bit shocked when the Mariners did win. And he did have to buy us the donuts. And I was thinking about that the other day, like, you know, in that moment, how happy I felt and how I thought, wow, we really showed that Yankees fan. But now, you know, however many years later, he's probably had a much...
much happier existence.
Much happier existence than us Mariners fans.
Yeah, they did go on to win, like, what, 5 of the next 7 championships, give or take.
Note that Katie quoted Mariners fans. So anyway, summers in 1995, right? You're hanging out with Hope, and...
All the time.
It's Hope Solo.
Just kicking the soccer ball around, right? Bob is telling her, maybe play goalie, right? I see this is your future.
Yeah. Instrumental in that. So instrumental, he was mentioned 0 times in her autobiography.
Wow. Didn't come up?
Didn't come up.
That's really offensive.
It is.
We were told that he was the first ever person to play her at goalie.
Well, her mom demanded it.
Her mom demanded that she play goalie?
Yeah.
In 1995, of all years.
I don't know if this is 1995.
It seems unlikely it was in 1995.
No, it wasn't. Definitely wasn't. It was like 1993.
She was probably playing like national program by 1995.
By 95?
Yeah.
I don't know how old we were.
I just remember this being like...
We were 13.
There were all these summers. I feel like the summers like 94 through 97 kind of run together. But you have these, again, just like... long hot summers when you're a child, right? And our mom would go to Costco and it was fudgesicles and the Twin Pop ice cream bars, right? Twin stick ice cream bars.
Well, what about Mr. Freeze's as well?
Oh, Otter Pops. And Otter Pops, right? You get your Otter Pops at Field Day, last day at Valley View.
Yeah. Yep.
And that would carry you through the whole summer, the excitement about Otter Pops. But the twin stick popsicles. And if I remember correctly, sometimes there would be banana in there, right? Banana and lime were options because the red always would get eaten. Red, blue, like blue raspberry and grape would get eaten first.
And you were trying to get the banana?
No. Okay. Banana is like
thank God.
Somehow worse than orange.
Yeah. Oh,
fake banana
sure.
flavor is the worst ugh. Flavor.
And sometimes it would sneak in there to whatever the twin popsicles were.
Even as a banana lover, as you know. noted banana lover.
Because you love bananas so much, you just can't handle fake bananas. I feel like there was maybe you were an orange person.
Yeah.
Or you would just suck it up and just eat the orange.
I don't mind the orange.
Orange is fine. Orange is fine.
Orange is trash. I mean, when Mrs. Fantasy Genius is on next week for 1996, we're going to talk about orange popsicles.
So you think lime is bad as well?
Yeah, I'm anti-lime also.
Oh,
depends on the popsicle. Some lime popsicles are good.
But now you would have like lime in your drink, right?
I'm fine with lime now.
But there's a difference between fake lime and real lime.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But I still like a lime popsicle.
I think now, in hindsight, over the summer, a fake lime popsicle sounds very refreshing.
How many minutes is this on popsicles so far?
But also,
too many.
Going to McDonald's and getting not a Happy Meal, an all-American meal.
No, Mom would never spring for the Happy Meal.
Never would spring for the Happy
expense
Meal.
What
was
for the
an
toy?
All-American meal?
It was a Happy Meal, basically without the toy.
Yeah.
And Kevin would get the hamburger one, not cheeseburger. Do you remember this?
I cannot defend my actions.
Why would you do this? You didn't like cheese?
I think it was because of the cost. I think Jan got to him. And it was like an extra 30 cents or whatever to get the cheeseburger.
The only disappointing thing is that we didn't buy our own Kraft singles and just stop it on after the fact.
Would do it. We're going to talk about 39-cent cheeseburgers later
on.
Oh,
man.
We're what
year
remember,
was that?
We're going to remember the
I
year.
I feel like that's late 90s, right?
It was when I was in high school and could drive, so.
Yeah. I think it might have been 2000 by the time that I got the burger that didn't have a patty.
Just
really
wait.
Disappointed.
Wait till we get to $5 footlongs. But I feel like that was like a staple of what we'd eat. And then Domino's before Domino's got better when it was just like cardboard. And still somehow... $1.50 Costco hot dog plus soda.
No.
Always. Even then in 1995, the price was the same as it is today.
That is crazy.
One thing I wanted to talk about, this technically came out in 1994, but we wouldn't have really played it until 95. NBA Live 95 was such a huge step forward for basketball video games. It was the first, like, good simulation basketball video game. NBA Jam was obviously very fun for the arcade style, but NBA Live 95 really cemented my love of basketball video games.
I just realized that I have to figure out what year GoldenEye came out.
That was later, right?
97, 98. The film GoldenEye came out in 1995.
We definitely did not go to that in 1995.
But the video game came out in 95 too?
I think this might have been an N64 summer.
Huh.
No, it came out in 97.
Yeah.
Wow, 2 years after the film.
Yeah.
Man, things move slow in the 90s.
I mean, things move so slow that it took them several days to get the caucus results.
Yeah, NBA Live 95 was a big deal. I think Madden 96, which actually came out in 95, was a pretty big deal. I think Donkey Kong Country was 94, if I recall correctly. I remember that being like, we have to get to the Super or to the N64 for you.
No, I'm just mad because I remember going over to your house and you would be so good at Donkey Kong and I could not play it because we didn't have the...
We had reps.
Fortunately, I was not very good at it. Came out in 94, yes.
My friend Michael Roddy came over in 1994 before we had a Super Nintendo, but we didn't have Donkey Kong Country yet. And he came over with the game and we played that fucker till like 5 in the morning. And it was like, I remember there's a level where the sun sets throughout the level, or there's levels where it's like it gets snowier throughout the level as you're walking. And this was the most amazing thing we had ever seen.
It is crazy looking like at the games now and then looking back at like the stuff that we thought was just so spectacular in 1995.
And now we're just like, whatever.
Yeah.
Who cares?
That person's face doesn't look exactly right.
But it was that was the summer. I feel like I was still in the summer of 95 playing Mario All-Stars, right? We're still hammering Donkey Kong, playing Mario All-Stars. When there weren't Braves games on.
Yes.
Because this was a pretty big Braves year, right? If I recall correctly.
I mean, this was also like the Mariners were in danger of moving. I can't talk about that because it was also in the McLemore documentary.
Yeah. We've heard him talk about it. What was the Braves' 1995 pitching staff?
Maddox, Glavin, Smoltz, Mark Wohlers was the number 4 starter?
No.
Or was he was the closer?
Steve Avery.
Oh, right.
Steve Avery. Kent Merker. 4 out of the 5 days, you're seeing like a pretty excellent pitcher pitch on TBS.
Yeah. I mean, so I think we've talked about this before, but in case the Mariners moved, we all picked different teams to be like our second team that we were going to support. And then we would all trade each other the baseball cards of that team. So it was like a great deal that we all picked different teams. You took the Indians.
Obviously. This Manram had a huge 95.
I took the Braves. I forget who the other picks were.
I don't think I partook in this exercise.
No, you were not around enough, sadly.
Manny had an over 400 on base percentage. 558 slugging. 960 ops in 95.
It was a very good Manny Ramirez season, including beating the Mariners in the ALCS.
This
our teams ended up meeting.
This was before steroids, maybe.
I don't think so.
I think he was the late Cleveland, early Boston years.
Our teams ended up meeting in the World Series that year. Right?
Oh, the Marlins and the Indians?
No, the Braves and the Indians.
Oh, the Braves and the Indians.
Yeah. Okay, we already talked about California Love, but you're going to hit us with hiphopgoldenage.com's.
Okay, before we get to list. Our good friends at hiphopgoldenage.com, I do have to mention there's two honorable mentions that I feel like really dominated that summer. Number one, the most important Wild Wave song ever. And then it's Quad City DJs with the train.
Is that just a Wild Wave song?
Well, it's a great song in all capacities.
It wasn't just a Wild Wave song, but you'd go to... So at that point, they were separate, Wild Waves and Enchanted Village. And you go to the Enchanted Village side and ride the train and sing the train over and over again.
Because you're cool.
Yeah, very cool.
There was also the high-fiving white guys on the Scrambler.
Yeah. On the Scrambler.
Man. Yeah.
You got to experience some of that, Katie. I'm so sorry. What was the... We really should talk about every time that 95 Columbia Cup winner, too.
I thought about what Water Follies
95.
Have we talked about how Kevin used to make like a brochure or whatever? Didn't you make like a book? Yeah, I swear
you
did.
We all did that.
We would all participate.
Don't you take yourself out of
really?
That.
I think we were cutting photos out of the newspaper.
We wouldn't let your youngest brother participate because he was too young. He was only 5. So, I mean, I don't know if this was specifically 95, but he had to get a second copy of the newspaper so he could make his own version.
Wow, I really
feel... It was like a book, right? That would like say who won and... Yeah. And then didn't we eventually do it on the computer when the computer was able to start printing out like
that seems likely.
Terrible
level
of graphics?
Kevin is into.
What do you remember?
Dear diary.
What do you remember?
Dear diary.
Just won the 1995 waterfall.
I don't know who it was.
We remember some years. 1996, the first Carcino Family Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God. Wow, that was 96.
That's a preview for
okay,
next week.
Pull up who won Waterfall is 95. Okay, so Quad City DJs with the train in a very important Wild Wave song. And then, seminal track for our childhood. It's Coolio with Gangsta's Paradise.
Oh, yeah, man.
Of course.
Just one of the most important songs of the 90s. Everything about it we remember till we're dead. And Amish Paradise, the parody of it, also very important. From our good friends at hiphopgoldenage.com.
I remember thinking that he was going to be like a star forever. Oh, like, you know, like
he is.
Well, okay. But,
I think he might write cooking books now.
And then he had like one other song after that.
Oh, we had Fantastic Voyage. That was like the first track. Slide, slide, we'll ride.
Okay, yeah.
When you're living in the city, it's do or die. And then Gangsta's Paradise came next, and you're like, Coolio's a career artist.
Yeah.
and then you heard Amish Paradise.
Then you get a little worried.
What about the High School High soundtrack? Did you have Coolio have any other songs on that?
I was looking up other tracks where I was like, this had to be 95, and they're all 1996.
Oh, okay. Well, that's exciting for next week.
So just wait. There might be a return next week.
Oh, hello.
1996. Okay. Number one from hiphopgoldenage.com, we have Dear Mama by Tupac. Tupac, getting a little serious.
Yeah. Classic.
At the time, the thought of knowing who Tupac's mom was so foreign to us as 10-year-olds. Number two, we have Shook Ones Part 2 by Mobb Deep.
Nice.
A track we certainly were not familiar with in 1995.
That's a retroactive one for us.
Yes.
Yeah.
The infamous
one. One of my better tweets ever.
What?
I tweeted that. Like when the Warriors looked shook for the second time against the Thunder in 2014.
Yeah.
Or 2015.
I remember that tweet.
We're not only reminiscing about 1995, we're also reminiscing about some of Kevin's best tweets ever.
Look, that's always.
Classic tweet.
Classic tweet. Put that in the Hall of Fame.
Podcast Hall of Fame tweet. That tweet hung on your family's fridge until you moved. At number three from KRS-One, MCs Act Like They Don't Know. A track also definitely not familiar with in 1995. A track we were familiar with in 1995, and maybe the most important song ever recorded. Ba-doom, boom. Still memorialized in the year, I think this was 2019, in the film Us. I got 5 on it.
Have you noticed how they started doing this with other songs?
What with other songs?
Like bringing them back?
Yeah, like a horror movie. We'll take like a classic. I can't remember which
one are they doing for The Invisible Man? That is a horror movie that's coming out. That was a joke. I have no idea.
But like
they had Ice Ice Baby and Parasite when I was watching that yesterday. You can't tell, but it's in there.
Is that a joke too?
Yeah, it's a joke.
I was like, did I miss
very
that?
Serious movie? You all reacted so seriously.
But it really is, like, it really carries forward to this day.
We're at the perfect, like, were the perfect amount of time away from 1995 for I Got Five on it to be in a major motion picture.
And when you hear that in like in the trailer and you hear the beat and you're like, oh yeah, this is it. But then it gets all creepy and you get super scared. Or that was just me.
I mean, the ads for it were very scary. I agree.
Man, there are so many classic songs from 1995. Really, Wu-Tang Solo, 1995. So at number five, I'm going to go a little bit farther. Because there's a lot of Wu-Tang Solo, right? We have 36 Chambers has happened. And then the Wu-Tang members all want to do their own thing. And at number five, we have I'll Be There For You, You're All I Need by Method Man, featuring Mary J. Blige, one of the most successful Wu-Tang solo recordings ever. At number six, Shimmy Shimmy Ya by ODB. Liquid Swords by GZA at number seven. I think hiphopgoldenage.com might be a little bit Wu-Tang heavy.
I mean, 1995 was Wu-Tang heavy.
And then Ice Cream featuring Method Man, Ghostface Killah, and Capadonna by, not Raekwon Battle, Raekwon the Chef. Yeah. And also, this is one, an honorable mention for being the song that we actually cared about the most in 1995.
More than The Train?
I distinctly remember watching this video where it was like, okay, we like The Train, but that was like a mainstream song. This was a little bit more underground. And the video would come on MTV, and it would be like, this fucking changed everything. It's Forgotten to Time.
What?
Keep Their Heads Ringing by Dr. Dre.
I mean, that is a great song. Was that underground?
No, but that's what we felt because it wasn't played on Cube. Like, they didn't play it on Cube. Huh. Over the way that they played I Got Five on it. It was like, this was an MTV song, and I Got Five on it was an Everywhere song. More of a like, Cube song. But it was like, that track he's in, like all these airplanes or whatever. And it's from the Forgotten Dre period, right? It's from the period when he raps yes. on 2001, which we'll talk about in 1999, of course.
I have some takes. Well, specifically about how he treats the Detox album.
But how he treats the Detox album?
There's contradictory statements on the Chronic 2001. We'll get to that.
That's what I'm talking about here. I've tweeted about this. Where he's like, how my last album was the Chronic.
You tweeted about this?
Yes.
Oh, man. Did I steal this take from you?
I think you stole this take from me. And it's pretty apparent.
I think we're going to have to reject your admission to the Peltoncast Hall of Fame.
You're out. You're out. My tweet's going in for once, finally. He says two different times on... We can talk about this when we get to 1999.
Yeah.
But on the 2001 record, it's pretty clearly understood that one track was probably written by Jay-Z and one track was probably written by Eminem.
Correct. Different ghostwriters.
Of people who are ghostwriting for Dr. Dre. But this was the music from the time period when he says, well, my last album was out, you weren't bumping me. And you knew who was bumping him.
But we were.
The Pelton Brothers in 1995 in Boulevard Park, Washington. Thank you, Dr. Dre.
So about the winners of the 1995 Budweiser Columbia Cup and Seafair Texaco Cup. Mark Tate in the Smokin' Joes.
Yes.
Year after, the sponsorship had passed from Winston with the Winston Eagle to Joe Camel and the Smokin' Joes.
Can we just look at this number 14, Ice Cube with the track Friday, wearing an old school Mariners hat in the video?
Nice.
That's the first year they, or I guess maybe they wore them in 94. But
this is how you win the AL West.
Correct. Love that teal.
Yeah, tell that to Macklemore.
And then the Seafair Texaco Cup was an extremely rainy Seafair Sunday. Mm. So rainy that we went home early, the only time ever in history, and Chip Hanauer and the Budweiser got the victory.
What?
Just that he remembers the only time in history. Have you been to every Seafair since then?
No, there was one year that I watched at your then-girlfriend's house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's the only one I skipped.
Really makes you think.
So that was 1995. We remembered a year. We're only 45 minutes into this podcast.
Great. I'm closing up the iPad. I'm good.
Yeah,
you're done now.
Your work is done.
Check out.
You can have fun talking about Husky basketball.
We still have to search for Seattle. We have so many things to get to. We still have to search for Seattle's best teriyaki at Ichiro Sushi and Teriyaki in Magnolia. As I may have mentioned on the pod previously, this was my go-to spot for teriyaki for many years when I worked for the Storm and our offices were in Inner Bay. And so I met up with one of my former coworkers there last week. And this was a big trip because So last
Magnolia is the farthest place on Earth and the most confusing place on Earth.
How is it confusing?
I don't know. I'm just very confused by Magnolia.
Also, we're going to Mill Creek. I'm pretty sure Mill Creek is farther.
That's podcast geography.
Yeah, wow. It sure is. So the thing that happened last summer, I took Bill Barnwell to this location because I told him that this was my favorite teriyaki.
And, name dropping again.
Yeah. Barnwell always wants to get teriyaki whenever he visits Seattle during the NFL offseason. And I went and I was like, this isn't that good. Was it just an off day, or did I misremember how good this place was, or did it go downhill?
What did Barnwell say?
He didn't say anything, but the fact that he didn't say anything said it all. Wow. But
are you sure your opinion wasn't influenced by him not liking it?
I don't think so.
He was talking the entire time about how momentum doesn't exist.
Momentum and teriyaki sauce don't exist. I went back this time, ordered me the spicy teriyaki.
I got that spicy chicken.
Yeah, the spicy chicken.
You didn't pull it, Zach Whitman, and just say sushi.
Well, they have sushi. Yeah, you would be fine. They actually, it's the bento.
Spicy teriyaki.
The bento box is quite good if you want to get the lunch bento. I've done that many times in the past. But it was, and weirdly, I'd never gotten the spicy there before. I had always just gone with the street chicken and gyoza. It was excellent. Wow. I don't know how you felt about it, but I loved it. I thought it was the best teriyaki we've had so far.
Interesting. It's a very unique teriyaki, right? There's a lot of sauce. So basically you have this is not a styrofoam container. So you worry that maybe it's not damaging the earth enough, but the box might be compostable. I'm just saying.
I ate in, so I didn't get a box at all.
You've got the main compartment, which has the spicy chicken teriyaki, and then rice in the two top compartments, and then the salad comes in a separate box.
Correct.
So the thing that I think is interesting is it's not like just the chicken teriyaki, which most often when you get chicken teriyaki, it's just teriyaki with the sauce. This has like onions in it.
Correct.
And various things. I think there might have been some peppers in there. It was a more complex teriyaki than we've had anywhere else. And it's really sauce heavy in a lot of ways. Like, they really drench the chicken in the teriyaki sauce that they do. And they're mixing it up in a pretty impressive way.
So if we go through my different criteria here, I gave this a 9 for chicken.
Okay.
An 8.5 for sauce. I used to think their sauce, I don't know, maybe a little sweeter before, or maybe that's the non-spicy, and I like
that
like a little
sweet?
Bit. I do.
Okay.
Which I know is pretty basic, but I do. 7 for extras. I think they're pretty middle of the road in that
What
regard.
Extras? What extras are you talking?
That's salad.
The only extras I'm looking for at a teriyaki place are like some sort of weird advertisement for something. And
the styrofoam box.
The styrofoam box.
Salad and rice and gyoza.
Maybe pronouncing my name wrong. Like, those are the only... The only extras that I'm looking for.
And an 8 for value, I would say. So far, I would say this is the leader in the clubhouse. My feelings were doubted back last June when I went here were revalidated of how much I love Ichiro Sushi and teriyaki.
Did you guys go there on the same day?
No. Huh. Different days. I don't know if I disagree with you. I think it's the best teriyaki we've had yet. I'm not sure if the threshold is this teriyaki worth traveling for? Because it was interesting in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I think that the chicken was maybe not quite as good as some of like local teriyaki places that I've been to.
Interesting.
And I mean, that the standard, we should go to the Miyako.
Obviously.
Next week.
Next week?
We should do it next week. What do you feel about Miyako teriyaki? That's the one next to Safeway.
Talking to me?
Yeah.
In Fairwood?
Yeah.
I'm not a teriyaki expert, but it's fine.
Oh, man. I think it's so good.
Wait, what are your teriyaki credentials?
I have no teriyaki credentials. I eat it sparingly.
You live in Seattle, so that's teriyaki credential.
Right? I don't eat it that much. There's like all these other foods that I would eat before teriyaki. Oof.
I mean, it's also true with us, but it's just got to be a part of a balanced diet, teriyaki.
Part of a balanced diet.
Very balanced. Well, you have your salad.
So. Momoto chicken sandwiches are part of the balanced diet. And then teriyaki.
I mean, it tastes good. I like it there. But I can't say that it would be like better than any teriyaki I've had anywhere else.
Well, that's true of teriyaki.
I know, like, that's the
question.
This is one place I am willing to travel for. Like, clearly I went and met Barnwell there for lunch last summer.
It is a unique teriyaki, and I'll definitely give them that. It just didn't quite hit me in the flavor as much as I wanted it to.
We'll see if anyone does.
I thought it was very good. And I think it was the best teriyaki that we've had so far. I don't know if it's worth traveling to Magnolia.
So next week, Miyako teriyaki in Fairwood for all of you who are traveling to Fairwood.
Hey, there's a lot of us out there.
There are dozens of us.
They actually live in Portland now.
Yes, the Jeremiahs. And also recommended BB's over, I guess they were both recommended
that
equally.
I cannot agree with.
Well, we're talking about food.
Are we rating these teriyakis on a scale?
No.
Okay.
Did you have a rating?
My rating is not necessarily worth traveling for.
Yeah, I mean, that's the scale.
How are you going to make a bracket out of this?
Unclear.
Okay.
We'll see.
Good.
It's just a feeling.
Oh, just a feeling.
I mean, I'm doing the scores.
I thought it was good. I mean, I love all teriyakis. And it was good, but by the end,
can you pluralize teriyakis?
I don't know. Maybe it was. It was pretty fucking good.
I don't know if you can.
Thank you. I agree. Thank you for that as well.
It was pretty good. This was a pretty good teriyaki.
I'd like to go back there
at some point. I was impressed by it. It's different than just local teriyaki, I feel like.
We got him to admit it. That's a win. With the start of February, that brings Seattle Burger Month, presented by Lil Woody's in Seattle Met, apparently, this year. So starting Tuesday, February 4th, as this podcast comes out, the first of four burgers from Brady Williams at Canlis with the good old burger with fry sauce, American cheese, dry-aged grilled beef patty, shredded romaine, sliced pickles, yubeshi onions, and a potato bun.
Hmm. Wait, could you say that one thing again?
Which part?
Yeah.
Yubish.
Yubishi?
What is that?
I don't know. It's a type of onion, apparently.
Many people are saying that he completely ripped off the Pelton Cast burger.
Saying that. We definitely did not have romaine on there.
You had a lot of yubishi onions on your burger.
We demanded. We had grilled onions.
I'm very intrigued by that burger. That burger sounds like it has everything that I like in a burger.
Week two is Eric Rivera of Otto. It's the Boricua burger. Two picadillo smash beef patties with Saison seasoning. Special sauce, plantain chips, stewed onions, Franz bun. The inspiration behind my burger comes from being a Puerto Rican growing up in the Washington state. Bring the flavors of my culture to the forefront and have people experience it for themselves. I'm down for experiencing those flavors. The plantain chips look good.
They look good. I don't know if that's a manageable eat, though. They're like...
It's a lot.
I need to look at this. Please zoom in. Man. That's a lot.
You know what, though? Usually there's less than the photo. So if there's like just one plantain chip, I think it'll work.
All right. Week three, February 18th through 24th, Logan Cox of Homer, the other Cox brother. No good. The Homer Sapien ingredients, date ketchup, za'atar spiced Tim's potato chips, chanterelle mushrooms, Port Salut cheese, 1/3 pound lamb patty, whipped garlic, Nigella seeded bun.
We've got za'atar spice, Tim's potato chips, and chanterelle mushrooms on here.
Yeah.
Huh. Are we assuming that this winter potato chips on burgers are in?
Apparently it's a thing, according to this. And then the final burger of the month, February 25th through March 2nd, Elizabeth Kenyon of Manolin with the Manolin sandwich. Ingredients, aji, amarillo, aioli, pickled red onions, chimichurri, sliced radishes, breaded pork tenderloin cutlet on a sesame-seeded bun.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, I think that's good. So the most important thing here is what you get if you get all four of the burgers.
Of course.
Our ongoing quest during Seattle Burger Month. And this year, it's a beanie that is a very good-looking Louise beanie.
It's a nice-looking beanie. Now, in the past, you've gotten a hat.
Burger hat.
An apron.
Mm-hmm.
And now a beanie.
Yes.
What was it last year? Was there something else that was not one of those? We didn't get it last year because I missed a week because of All-Star and there was the snow. You guys were snowed in for like 3 weeks.
Literally the month of February.
It was a rough burger month. I
blame Goff. I don't remember what it was last year. I think it might have been a t-shirt.
I could actually scroll down the page. It appears it's on here. It was a tote bag last year.
I think the beanie is a lot better.
But it'd be cool maybe if you could just outfit yourself in all of the Little Woodies.
Yeah, Little Woodies head to toe.
Yeah, head to toe, yeah. Maybe not cool, but it would be a thing you could do.
By no means. Would it all at once be cool? All right, so be sure to check that out at your local Little Woodies. With that noted, it's time for the Coach's Corner, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci needs to be knocked down a peg. They don't.
What?
And so do we.
I want to break in to talk about Pagliacci for a second here, because I went after the Husky game last Thursday, and it had been a couple months, and I had forgotten Pagliacci's really good.
Yeah.
So I had the...
How do you forget that Pagliacci's
good?
I don't know,
but I just did.
If we don't have one in the South End, so
that's an issue. That's something we need to work on.
Yeah, if we that is part true. Of our you know, since you're so close to them, you can make that happen. Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
I had the seasonal one of the seasonal slices.
I like that your notes are just
what you had at
Coach's Corner, and then your notes are just what you had at Pagliacci.
Well, I need to remember the name, which is the Amatriciana. With pancetta, quite delicious, but then also the classic pepperoni was so good as well. So, but definitely check out the Amatriciana while it's there.
The best thing about Pagliacci is you can go and get the special, and then also you know you have your old standby, your classic. But you can try the new thing and like.
I was definitely inspired while I was there that we need to do the search for Seattle's best slice.
Just a slice.
What's the best slice at Pagliacci? Pitting them all against each other.
Oh, that'd be fun.
It's gonna be an important search for us to do. Suffice it to say.
Sure.
Because we know that the best slice in Seattle is coming from Pagliacci.
It's just a question of which Pagliacci slice.
So our game this week. This was one that you mark on the schedule.
Oh, Jan marked it.
Jan actually showed up.
I know. I was shocked. Shocked to see her there. Should we describe? Does the listener know Jan's animosity towards this opponent?
It would be weird if they did.
Last year in this league, they were the Cal Bears.
Word travels.
And I think the team was probably more dominant last year.
Yes.
But this team just destroyed us last year, right?
Yeah.
So the coach of the team is a strength and conditioning coach for the Storm.
Something like that, yes.
Right, and this is word that's it's like spreading throughout the stands, right? Because they kicked our asses so bad last year at basketball, and Jan is just disgusted watching the game. She's just like, "How are you not more angry about
this?"
It's
a reminder they do not keep score during these games. If this is your first edition of the
coach's
score, first
grade basketball, that she's just like, "Oh, they just get all the best players together." It's terrible, terrible. I hate when people do that.
She basically complained about player empowerment.
It's a warrior argument or something.
Yes. How dare they get Kevin Durant?
And she was just like, "Oh, I never want to see that team play ever again." And so I see the coach's name on the schedule this year, and I anticipated seeing their name on the schedule this year. And I was just like, "Jan, this is not going to be one you want to come to." Like, I'm assuming that if they had this team together last year,
right.
And there's all these fucking rumors in the crowd where they're like, they practice 3 times a week. Or whatever.
I love this. Oh man, the crowd is buzzing.
Yeah. It's just like basically like nonsense. They're like, they play AAU together.
We said the same thing about the Indians during the 95 ALCS.
They're like, "Oh, these kids have been," it was the same during football this year where they're like, "Oh, that team plays tackle football together too." And I'm like, how are you verifying this? Literally any person could just be like, say something. And you're like, I guess that checks out. I don't know. There's not a lot of oversight happening for these small children playing.
So you're saying
sports.
We need more investigative journalism for your league?
Yes, for the sidelines. We need better sideline.
Challenge
reporting.
Accepted.
You there with your
veteran
press
sideline
hat.
Reporter?
Yeah. Maybe you bring some of your friends that you're always name dropping about. Dear diary.
I hung out with Barnwell today. It was the best.
Me and Bill Barnwell had teriyaki today. What a good experience. Bill didn't like the teriyaki as much as I would have liked him to, though. But so we were going into this game, and Jan has just been like, she's not going. or whatever, she cannot see this team play because she can't stand to see super teams. This is the one thing that Jan cares about. But she sucked it up and so decided crazy. To go. I don't really know how that process happened.
Maybe she decided to support her grandchild and
I don't think that was part of it.
Don't tell her that ratings are down this year after the Warriors broke up. Don't let her know.
And we were watching them pregame, and it was like, the team didn't look quite as dominant.
Pregame.
The warm.
I mean, it just means before the game.
I know, it just makes it seem like there's a televised thing for the 7-year-old game.
We were over there. Brooke Olsendam was interviewing the kid with the long hair. And they have one kid on this team who is pretty excellent, who I think is the coach's child.
No.
Not your, because Jan claimed this wasn't, but then Kaylin claimed it was.
Sharon knows the coach, and she says.
She knows the coach?
Yes.
Wow.
She's very nice. And that her daughter is on the team.
Which one is her daughter?
Maybe the one with braids, but that was unclear. Couldn't get that confirmed. But the son.
How does Sharon know the coach?
I don't know. Just, you know, living in the area?
All right.
Anyways, okay.
We can discuss some of this
moving
offline.
Moving on. So there's one
if Bill Barnwell knew the coach, we could talk about it on the podcast.
Sure, for hours.
We still haven't even talked about Dave yet.
So there's one kid who can, like, do a layup.
Oh, he was, like twirling layups and stuff.
Yeah, like, if you're in second grade basketball.
It's a superpower.
And you can do a layup. It's a superpower, yes. Yeah. And the other thing is, he has a nice mid-range game, which is, like, a shot from, like, 2 feet from the basket. Which, you know, Ella was telling me after the game that she did really good, and she told Ben, she's like, I hit some three-pointers. And I was like, Ella, you were maybe 3 feet from the basket.
A shot.
And that's not like a long range. She's like, I got some long-range shots on. And no. But when they're in second grade, if the ability to shoot outside of the, you know, 1 foot from the hoop is really... Yes. Also important.
That kid kept saving balls in bounds when he was jumping. Man. I was like, even if he's out of bounds, the refs were just so enchanted by it that they did not care at all. If I could describe his play in terms of sound, it was. He was out there just making like twirling layups against.
You know, he took it easy on us too.
According to whom?
To me. He slowed up the dribble when he could have just been taking it to the rack every single time.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I thought he did. I thought he slowed up on us, and I thought maybe they told him not to go
as hard. Luka played pretty
good
D against him.
No, he did. But there was times when he could have done a fast break, and he just kind of jogged up the court.
Loafing already.
Well, so in this game, I told Luka, I was like, in tribute to Kobe, you've got to score 8. 24 or 81. It's like you have 3 options here, and he was going for 81 in the third quarter. He took a lot of shots. It was the most ball dominant that I've ever seen him be.
Luka did really good. He focused on hitting layups, which was.
This is coming off his lesson from practice on Tuesday night that if you just dribble the ball towards the basket, you probably will get a better shot.
Really worked on that.
So I'm going to say he scored 81. No. He might have scored 8 points. I think that actually might be true.
That sounds about right.
He had an assist to Ella.
Yeah, that was great.
Which I thought was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And keeping it in the family assist.
Yeah.
It was like the Morris brothers.
Hopefully it wasn't like the Morris brothers last week.
Oh, dear. No, he definitely wouldn't have passed it to Ella.
Did not approve of Ella's game.
No.
But then also at some point, you know, Katie and I feel like we're maybe slightly more animated than the other coaches in the league.
Much more animated.
Yeah, and because this is my only context for the game, is I getting a message in our G-Chat conversation, just thinking about how the ref asked, are you guys okay when he made a bad call? So tell me what happened here.
I think this is referring to every time when we, under our hoop, when we were trying to score, whatever that is, our hoop, and it would go out of bounds, and he would call it for the other team, no matter who it went off of.
There was a ball where we definitely dribbled it off of the other team's player. Look, I'm not saying this was a high-skilled play by our team.
No.
But we dribbled it off the foot of the other team. And they called it for them, and we were pissed.
I think we might have thrown our hands up in the air. And then he looks over at us, and he does a, are you guys okay? You know, like come on, this is a second grade basketball game.
Hey, he was kind of get it together. This was when that kid, the twirly kid, had a steal.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
stealing
yeah.
is not allowed. And I felt like, come on. It was just like, this kid shouldn't be allowed to do that much. He's already better than every single other player in the league.
That is what I thought. Like, especially when it would go out of bounds off questionable.
Yeah.
And they have this kid who can do twirly layups and jump shots and stuff like that. Like, maybe just side with the other team. Maybe don't side with the team with the kid with the twirly layups. Mm-hmm. You know? That's all.
But the ref was like, we good here?
So what was the approximate final score of this game?
It wasn't that bad.
I never know. Never know.
Is they were good, but it wasn't like, it wasn't embarrassing and it wasn't difficult to watch. And I think that was...
It was on like Hard to Watch, the Tracy Jordan mm-hmm. movie.
I think until we had the fourth quarter, we had a little bit of a lapse.
Yeah, the fourth quarter. Also, I'm just putting this out there. We just play it a little bit more straight than other teams do. You know what I mean? Like other coaches, you know, they like to overload in the games that you don't keep scoring. And they like to play their best players as many quarters as possible.
I don't actually feel like other coaches have done that.
Don't worry about it. This coach played, that kid played three quarters, and our two best players didn't play three quarters in this game because they did last game. And most importantly, so last season, even though I felt like, I don't know, I feel like the team this year has kind of put it together.
I think
we're maybe better at coaching.
Don't know if I'd say that. I wouldn't give any credit to ourselves. Mm. I think these kids
give a lot of credit to ourselves.
I think these kids just maybe want to play basketball a little bit more.
They are willing to learn more than
they give the effort.
Yeah.
Which is important.
There are no kids on this team who just do not want to be there.
No. They all want to try. And they just don't get some things yet, but everybody wants to try. That's good.
That's half the battle.
Yeah.
But last year against this team, it was like, it was frustrating. And this year, I don't think it was frustrating. It was like, they won, but it wasn't destruction. But most importantly, Katie and I are not available on Saturday. And that means
he's
all
sweating
alone.
Already.
Dear diary, I coached a basketball game today. Is what ESPN's Kevin Pelton will be writing on Saturday when the kids, they have no idea who is going to be coaching their team. This isn't Bill Barnwell. No. Fresh off the NBA's trade deadline, we will have head coach Kevin Pelton.
My favorite part of each practice is when we ask if they know who Kevin is.
Yeah.
And they all go, no.
Except your two children.
Yeah.
They thankfully do recognize
Luke and Ella know who you are. Most of the kids barely know what each other's names are.
Yeah. No. So. We have to work on that every practice and they still don't know it.
I'm going to put in several zone defenses.
Illegal.
Wildly so. Design some out of complex out of bounds plays.
Please do.
Good God. Yes.
It's not great. No.
All that time complaining about how Romar and now Hopkins can't design an out of bounds play, and wow, I see it's really tough to do.
I feel like they have... the Huskies designate one person to pass it in, one person to receive the pass.
Oh, that was the other thing that was funny about the game is that my daughter told me that she didn't realize because we had designated one person to pass it in and one person to catch it that. If we were passing it in under
our opponent's hoop, you
could actually try to get open for the basket. So she just turned, looked away from the ball, and walked completely away from it. It's like, no, that's not what that means.
The Huskies did the same thing against North Carolina in the NCAA tournament. We'll never forget. So do you have any other plans as sole head coach?
Not really. Probably some clapping on the sidelines. I've taken most of my coaching style modeled after Jason Garrett, the clapper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You want to do exaggerated pointing about where you think the ball goes? I think that might help work the refs a little bit.
They love it.
I definitely, it's a more reserved style when I'm coaching, I think.
Oh, I always wonder what the parents are thinking, but then I like realize that the parents are only staring at their own child the entire time. Nobody's looking at us, so it doesn't fucking matter.
There you go.
Yeah. If you could stand up, though, and work the refs, that'd be pretty fun.
I'm not going to do that.
You did the first game. You're the one.
Well, I did stand up. That is correct.
Also illegal.
I did not know that was against the rules.
You're the only person. They thought you were just a parent and was concerned about their child.
Little did they know, I don't have any children out there on that court.
You should tell all the parents that before the game. And be like, yeah, I don't have any kids in this game. I'm just here coaching. Totally normal.
The good news is all adults look the same to the kids. We may as well be the same person.
You should just say you are, Tristan.
Yeah. I might be on a plane while this is happening. When I missed the first game, I was like, it was the first game of the year, so I was pretty curious to see how the kids would play. But like, I like watching the kids play basketball. It's fun. So I'm sad to be missing it, and then also the subsequent games that I'm missing.
But this is the worst game because of the fact that it's both of you missing it and leaving me alone.
Oh, I can't wait.
Well, the reason I wasn't at last Saturday's game is because I was heading down to Portland to see the Blazers take on the Jazz and to see the latest episode of the NBA's best show right now, the Damian Lillard show. He went for 51 in this one, got to 50 with a pair of free throws late in the game. It was his third game of 50 or better in the last six. He has, over that span, become the first player in NBA history in a six-game span to average 45 points and 10 assists.
Who are the other ones? Kobe?
He was the first.
Oh, the first player. I thought you said the third player.
He's tied for third most points in a six-game span with a Kobe stretch. That's since the merger, I think. Yeah, not all time, obviously. Wilt would have higher. He scored 100 points in the game. Behind two James Harden stretches last year. Like, he's been player of the week both 2 weeks in a row. This is one of the most incredible stretches of basketball that I or anyone else have ever seen. So.
Good for Dame.
You have any Blazers questions?
I have a Blazers question.
Yeah.
Yes.
Since I haven't been paying attention to Blazers basketball. Really fallen out of the league ever since Isaiah Thomas has broken himself or gotten broken.
You're not paying attention to basketball at all?
I mean, I watch the Lakers because Ben watches the Lakers some from time to time, but.
Because you like.
So you saw Friday night's basketball. Game.
I didn't. No, no, no. I didn't. From time to time.
I see.
I'm not really tuning in to anything. I just have lost the, you know.
Just UW basketball?
Yeah, I really do just watch UW basketball.
You have a lot in common with the American viewing populace.
They're also upset.
Their reasons aren't because of Isaiah Thomas's hip or whatever. But I haven't paid close enough attention to know if this has brought them back into playoff contention.
They're a game and a half out of the eighth seed. Ooh. So looking are two games, I guess, because Memphis won earlier tonight before we recorded this podcast. But the Grizzlies' schedule gets a lot more difficult the next few weeks here. And then with the Blazers getting, at some point here, Yusuf Nurkic and Zach Collins back, like they're probably at this point the favorites to finish eighth in the West.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How does the egg on your face feel?
Wow. Ugh. I told Tristan that I thought they were going to go 0-2 last weekend because the emotional Kobe celebration game in LA that they were playing on Friday night.
That seemed like a guaranteed loss.
And then they were going to have to play a very difficult back-to-back. They didn't get back until 2:20 in the morning on Saturday night was when their plane landed. And then playing a Jazz team that had been sitting there in Portland waiting for them. And Dame was just so good, it didn't matter. And Hassan Whiteside was really awesome in both these games.
Hassan is pretty good.
Which is interesting timing with the trade deadline coming up, where Whiteside was seemingly an obvious candidate to be traded, and now suddenly a more difficult decision. Also some talk about Whiteside and Nurkic playing together.
Hello, Twin Towers!
When Nurkic returns, so I don't think that will work at all.
There's some talk about how beautiful Yusuf Nurkic's suits are.
There's a lot of talk about
After the game on Friday, Kaelin was like, who was that man that just came up to Dave?
It was also like very awkward. Dave was giving his emotional answer about Kobe and everything the night meant. And Nurk comes up talking about how great he is. It's like, read the room, Nurk. Read the room.
No, Nurk doesn't read any rooms. There's nothing that could be said about Damian Lillard beyond what the Portland crowd has said about Damian Lillard, and that is MVP. Best basketball player in the NBA right now. Carrying a team. He's just like, this is the greatest performance that we've seen. The most fun thing that you can see in basketball is one player. Like, fundamental basketball is fun or whatever, but actually it's fucking bullshit. Seeing a bunch of
pads on the table.
Like, seeing a bunch of passes, it's like the Warriors.
It really does.
The Warriors are like, oh great, they made another pass for a wide open fucking three for Klay Thompson. Whoop-de-fucking-do. The most exciting
fun.
The Warriors have never been fun. The most exciting basketball.
Shooting from the half court or whatever.
You reminds me of Steph Curry, whose record for threes over a six-game stretch that Dame broke, right?
Threes aren't on their own exciting. It's not exciting. Look, was Steph Curry playing with, like, Wembley and Henderly?
It's Wenyen Gabriel.
Right? Like, I mean, Dame was literally out there with rec league players doing rec this. League? Steph Curry is like, you can win 73 games when you have all the best players, but Dame is doing it with nobody. He has Smush Parker on his team. And it was just like, basketball is the most fun when you have one player who's just like, fuck it, I am taking this team on my back and winning this game. And that is what Dame Lillard is doing right now. He is single-handedly saying, I'm not letting the Blazers fall out of playoff contention. We were a 3 seed last year. We won 2 playoff series last year. Dame Lillard is beyond an elite-level player. He is an MVP-caliber player in the NBA. He's the best player in Portland Trailblazers history right now, and he's carrying them. This is the greatest performance since 2006, Kobe Bryant.
Who didn't win MVP?
Because it's a fucking sham.
Also, what about Harden last year?
Harden does it by driving and getting ridiculous fouls. Like, Harden is not...
I mean,
he's not playing
backs.
Basketball. Come That's on. Not, Dame hoops, Harden takes advantage of rule changes.
I know.
Dame, you
not
can't
sure
even argue this. You can't
it.
Argue this. Dame
I mean,
plays
step
basketball.
Back is kind of like a evolution of
travel,
a
clear travel. But like, do you have fun watching James Harden?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
You're the only person on Earth.
It's not as unfun
Maybe
as it used to be.
Not defensively, but on offense.
Harden
I
sucks.
Mean, is it not fun to see Luka step back and hit a three?
Oh, I love Luka. When he steps back, it's different. Harden is just like, it's so frustrating to watch. When he goes to the hoop and you're just like, players who are looking for fouls, you're just like, this is not interesting basketball. In fact, I think that they should maybe call their own fouls.
No, that would definitely work out well.
And the free throw.
I feel like Marcus Morris had some fouls to call on Jay Crowder or vice versa.
And the charge and the free throw.
Well, I look forward to the Blazers making the playoffs, because I definitely will become more locked into tuning in to the basketball at that point.
If they do.
I mean, you've convinced me.
I mean, there's still a lot of other teams in the mix, so we'll see.
When does Nurk come back?
So there was a report from my friend Eric Garcia Gunderson of USA Today Sports that
you me again.
Have teriyaki with him.
Yeah. Dear diary, I hung out with Eric Garcia Gunderson today.
That he was not going to come back until after the All-Star break. Jason Quick of The Athletic refuted that report, said that no date had been set, but also over the weekend there was a setback. I think he suffered like a calf strain or a hamstring strain. And so that's going to put his timetable back a little bit, just in terms of him being able to work back on the court. So I still think back half of February is the likely timetable.
Dame does not need Nurk.
Dame could use
yeah,
Nurk.
Dame's scoring 50 on his own.
I don't know that he's going to keep doing this. Yeah, it's a calf strain. I don't know that it's going to continue forever. Should we talk Seattle sports?
Wow.
We've gone almost an hour and a half without doing it.
Do we have to?
We talked about Seattle sports in the 90s.
It's true.
Is Husky basketball included in Seattle sports?
Unfortunately, it is. Oh, on NHL Network Radio last week, John Hoven of the Mayor's Manor blog reported that he's heard the NHL Seattle team will be named the Kraken. Is transcribed by the Capitals blog, Russian Machine Never Breaks. From everything I've heard, it looks like Seattle Kraken is going to be the name. which is quite surprising, actually. When I was given that information just a couple of days ago, I was in a little bit of shock personally, just because we had been told several times previously that was not the name they were going for. It looked like they were leaning towards Sockeyes. He attributed that change to legal issues with the trademarked name in local author Jamie Davenport's romance series. Davenport said that she's not standing in the way, but has not heard from the team about her trademark. NHL Seattle posted on Twitter, "Well, we're aware of some fishy rumors surrounding our team name. Please rest assured we're doing our due diligence by scouring the depths of the ocean, the tallest mountains, and the densest part of the forest to find the right name for our great green city." Hovind also indicated...
It sounds like it was written by a transplant to Seattle. There's no way a person from Seattle wrote that tweet.
It's aggressive. Hovind also indicated the team colors would include red, teal, and black, similar to what NHL Seattle has been using thus far on its website. But he did warn the leak could be an intentional misdirection.
Oh, hello.
So we're expecting a team name announcement in March. I mean...
Why are people so mad about Kraken?
Like, I don't know. Like, why? Just regress your opinion to the mean here, people.
I think that some people really wanted the Sockeye.
Why? I mean, it's my personal... I actually prefer steelheads to Sockeyes myself, but...
It seems like more of a real thing than like a... The Kraken seems more like a...
But it's not exactly a very intimidating team name. I gotta be honest with you.
The Sockeyes is like...
Sockeye.
Black eyes. You know what I mean? They're socking you in the eye.
It's very
hard. I guess it's a pun.
You didn't get that?
Oh, no. Mr. Pun over here.
Professional writer and or professional pun maker?
God, isn't that what 90% of your Twitter is?
It is.
And look, of our most framed tweets of yours.
Some of our Hall of Fame tweets.
Yeah. The tweets that are on Bob's refrigerator.
What was the pun last week? Oh, about past a common and being just right.
Yeah, nobody is aware of this movie. Are you aware of this movie?
No.
Okay.
It's a famous motion picture.
Just Right is what it's called. He's on the Nets?
Yes.
The New Jersey Nets?
I believe at the time it was the New Jersey Nets, yes.
Nobody's heard of this movie.
But it was fitting because he was courtside at a Brooklyn Nets game as this play happened.
Yes. Well, anyway, Sockeye means punching also.
I hadn't thought about that. Okay. All right, well, I don't have any strong feelings here.
Why do you like steelhead?
Steel.
Okay. I mean, I guess that kind of goes to your point about why everybody's so upset about Kraken. Like,
what is it really? Like,
yeah, it's not.
First off, anything's going to sound better once you've heard it like 1,000 times as opposed to it just being a hypothetical made-up name.
It's weird how upset people are about Kraken.
Yeah.
I'm just like, sure, they could be the Kraken.
I can't think of any other event right now where people are taking sides and taking it way too personally, even though ultimately you probably should just support whatever comes out as the choice.
If we ever find out who the choice is. Stay tuned to this podcast.
Supposedly we'll get the team name in March. So, again, stay tuned whether we get any other news before that.
Many tabulation errors.
On the Sounders front, they introduced João Paulo as their third designated player last week. That's notable. And that a report from The Athletic last month indicated that teams with three designated players would be required to either have one under age 23, which the Sounders do not, or one capped at a maximum salary of $1 million plus the maximum budget charge. Officially, João Paulo was acquired on a one-year loan with an option to buy after the season, at which point he could be bought out of the designated player spot using targeted allocation money. So perhaps that's what the Sounders are planning. Remains to be seen whether this proposed new rule regarding designated players would come into play this season, and also exactly what the new MLS collective bargaining agreement is going to look like at all. The expiration of the current CBA has been pushed back to this Friday as talks continue between players and the league. Additionally, on the Sounders front, summer 2019 edition, Emmanuel Cecchini was officially loaned to Union de Santa Fe for the remainder of 2020 through the expiration of his loan to the Sounders, so he won't play, presumably, for Seattle again. No confirmation is yet on the rumored addition from Union de Santa Fe of Yaimar Gomez Andrade to the back line to play alongside Javier Arriaga at center back. But Sounders GM Garth Lagerwey said that another addition using targeted allocation money could be announced as soon as this week. Let's turn our attention to Husky sports. Last week, Mike Vorell of the Seattle Times reported that Stanford QB KJ Costello had visited as a possible grad transfer, but we got news from him on Instagram on Monday that he has chosen instead to transfer to Mississippi State.
I have a hot take.
Coached by one Mike Leach.
We didn't want him anyways. That's my hot take.
That's
my,
not
my
a
husband,
good hot take.
Ben, who is a Cougar. He was like, haha, we finally won something that you guys, or you guys finally lost something or something.
We
or
lose might, things no, all the time.
That's what he said. That's okay.
Finally
said.
Lost
Scratch
to
that.
Mike Leach.
Yeah, we finally that, lost to joke. Mike Leach.
Oh,
yeah,
that
that's
was
a joke.
Pretty good comment.
It
and
is.
I'm sorry for butchering that, Ben. But
yeah, he doesn't remember the 11 years ago that
like,
we lost to Mike Leach.
When he was at Texas Tech.
Did he win his first game against UW or whatever?
No.
He never won.
Oh, maybe he did.
He beat UW one
You're
time.
Right. He did beat UW yeah. once. Yes,
yeah.
Right.
Okay. It was just wasn't against Coach Pete.
No, no. It was, and then not the last Sark game.
Yeah. But I was like, I didn't think we actually wanted him, but apparently you're going to tell
you
me.
You didn't yeah. want KJ Costello?
No, I'm confident in who we have.
In...
You know who's not confident in who we have?
Jimmy Lake?
Yes. Also, by the way, I have a random rant here, which is, why do they always talk about adding a transfer, quote, to the QB room? Why is it got
oh,
to be the QB
your
room?
QB room complaint. Yeah. Yeah. I thought you were talking about some Seahawks thing or whatever. I was like, let Geno Smith live.
Can't it just be to the roster? Why does it have to be specifically to the room? What's so special about the QB room in particular that we have to reference it?
It's like the transfer portal. It's just like a thing now.
That really also drives me crazy when people say they have entered the transfer portal. Like, it's not a fucking time machine. You don't enter it. You just put your name in there, guys. I don't know what it is about the world portal that it seems so futuristic to it. But here's the thing. KJ Costello in 2018
Hello.
Is a full-time starter, is it at that point a redshirt sophomore, led the Pac-12 in QBR at 82.6.
Oh,
that was a conference that included...
He's not going to be in the conference. It doesn't matter. He's going to get fucking throttled in the SEC. Have fun, KJ!
Yeah, I'm not sure this is actually a great decision for him because there's a thing about Mike Leach's offense. They don't tend to protect their quarterback yeah. real well. So I wouldn't recommend it, even though he'll put up huge stats. But
against
of,
who? He's not going to put up huge stats. We'll talk about that in a second.
He will put up huge stats. Quarterbacks in the Pac-12 in 2018 included starting quarterback of the Jacksonville Jaguars and Good Place finale wow. referencee Gardner Minshew.
Wow.
Future first-round pick Justin Herbert. Minnesota Vikings practice squatter, Jake Browning.
Remember him.
Those are all the notable quarterbacks. And Tyler Huntley, who was awesome last season in terms of QBR. So even though he had a really down 2019, losing his job to Davis Mills and dealing with injuries, I still think that he would have been a huge upgrade for the Huskies.
I don't have any retort. I don't have any statistical retort to this. Like, I just didn't think he was that good based on the old eyesight test. And
no, we don't use that around here.
I know. But, I mean, we don't know how good the Huskies...
We do not know how good they are. That is a good point. But you know what we know is that none of them played ahead of Jacob Eason.
But Jacob Eason regressed a little bit, I think. Like
nobody was starting... That's bullshit. Nobody was starting ahead of Jacob Eason, no matter what.
Yeah, that's...
It was his starting job.
I thought we were always competing around here. I know it's not the Seahawks, but I
nobody
we were doing
actually
here.
Ever said that the Huskies were always competing.
All right. Okay. You want to talk about KJ Costello at Mississippi State?
Well, I guess two things. I mean, we would have preferred. It's sort of. It's a devil's gambit. Of
define the, devil's gambit.
It's a deal with the devil, right? Okay. The transfer game is not a game that you necessarily want to be playing.
Correct.
Right? Like, it can work every once in a while if there's the right player. And I think KJ Costello probably is the right player. But let's say that you bring KJ Costello. Let's say he even gets in.
The devil's gambit is the practice of deliberately delaying or preventing process or change, which I guess actually does
yeah,
work
that does.
Because they were preventing a change at quarterback.
Dear Diary. Today I roasted Kevin Pelton from ESPN.
Unintentionally.
Unintentionally.
It's not a deal with the devil.
Who has an English major here?
Yeah.
We have a degree, not a major. Sports marketing. By bringing on a grad transfer quarterback, you have 1 year that you more or less, you don't guarantee, but you give yourself a very good shot of having an experienced quarterback who probably would be the best quarterback in the quarterback room, which I like to reference often. And
it's a good term. Yeah.
Yeah. But it does have negative long-term impacts. If they were to have brought in KJ Costello, they could have had two quarterbacks transfer, right?
Quite possible.
Not just one. And so if you go through training camp, if you go through spring football and then training camp and somebody's going to win the job, right? You might have one quarterback transfer or you might not have either quarterback transfer.
I think you definitely would have had quarterbacks transfer. And I think it also sends a bad message to recruits if you have two transfer quarterbacks in a row.
Well, or I mean, you give a chance for freshman Ethan Garber to win the job.
Yes.
And every quarterback?
Yes.
Every team.
I mean, not literally every team. Obviously, the Huskies hadn't in the past, but like, it's very common.
If Ethan Garber is the best quarterback, as we talked about recently,
like all the Heisman Trophy winners lately until this year had all transferred.
Actually, the one this year.
I'm sorry, through this year? Yes. until Trevor Lawrence wins next year.
But the reality is the next Trevor Lawrence is not a transfer quarterback, right? Like, this isn't the Oklahoma offense. They're not going to just pick up a transfer quarterback and be excellent.
But what if the next quarterback is Sam Huard, and then that causes everyone to transfer anyway?
It might be.
Isn't there a lot before Sam Huard?
He's going to be a junior in high school.
No, he'll be a senior this year. He's currently a junior.
We're talking about a senior in high school right now, and like... That's a lot to put on him. And if Garbers wins the job, or Dylan Morris wins the job, or Jacob Sermon wins the job, whomever that is, they're going to be a very good quarterback, right? And like, what we should be looking at developing, this is going to be a little, this is going to appeal to you, the next Jake Browning.
This didn't appeal to me.
We shouldn't be looking for year after year after year finding. We shouldn't
be looking for the next Jacob Eason.
Yeah, we shouldn't be doing that. We should be looking for the long-term answer at quarterback, who's going to be your quarterback for 3 years instead of your quarterback for one season. And that's why it is a devil's gambit, because you're saying, well, look, this is 1 year where we have a quarterback who we know is probably better, maybe better than anybody who we have in the quarterback room right now. Well, but I mean, if we're you won not the job, going to by be definition, developing the quarterback of the future. It really is trading like a more experienced quarterback versus trading somebody who you can develop yourself. And we just have to have confidence in this program that they're going to be able to do it, because I don't UW.
But are they
going
to be able to do it in time for Michigan is coming to town in 7 months here.
Fuck like, Michigan.
Is transfers a sustainable practice for UW? Due to their transfer rules.
No, but they can't do it this year
and the next year and the year after that.
They didn't need to do that.
Why didn't they?
Because Sam Huard's coming in.
Why do you just assume that a quarterback who has not played his senior year in high school is the answer because his last name is Huard? Look, motherfucking Garbers has a brother who's playing Pac-12 football.
And constantly beating the Huskies.
Like, what? Because... as far as I understand from the Huard family, you can delete this and all, but he's probably just going to hand the ball off a lot.
Oh, God.
I don't see a lot of passing in Sam Huard's future. I'm just saying, like, you can't assume that Sam Huard is the answer.
No, but I'm just saying that I don't think it would be necessarily a situation where you're like, okay, because of the fact that they recruited KJ Costello, now you're committing to 25 years of transfer quarterbacks. I think it was a stopgap year because you didn't have any experience.
This was Jimmy Lake looking for a quick answer. This was Jimmy Lake looking for 1 year if we know we'll
this
be
is Jimmy Lake looking to compete at every position. You would like, would you not bring in a, I mean, it
I'm,
doesn't
I'm
happen at
the
same way at
the
other positions,
end of the world.
But would you not bring in a player at another position just because of the fact that you had young players there? No, of course not.
Let me give you a trade-off though. Would you trade 1 year of maybe competing for the Pac-12 football versus 2 years of competing, or even a year competing at national championship level football?
Well, obviously not if that's the transfer the trade-off, but I don't think that's a reasonable expectation for the quarterbacks on the roster. I mean, again, the fact that they were pursued Costello as aggressively as they did tells us something about how they feel about the quarterback room.
They haven't even seen Ethan Garbers yet.
How do we know how aggressively they pursued him?
The fact that he visited the campus is pretty aggressive. Nobody else has visited the campus.
I visited the campus.
Yeah, I visited from time to time.
Often.
No, I visited last Thursday. Wasn't that great? No,
that's
campus.
Why he didn't go.
The campus is terrific. Fucking,
he said Mississippi State or whatever. It looked better.
No.
It makes sense why you would want to go play
last
week.
It was a bad time to bring KJ. He's been at Stanford. Do you know how nice it is there? During February?
Stanford.
I mean, in
never
May, take the quad at any time.
That's what I'm saying.
When the cherry blossoms.
Those cherry blossoms
more like
have
April,
not sprung yet. Like I've been there in May when those cherry blossoms are going, and there's 43 million people on campus. But I'm just saying this isn't the end of the world. Look, would we prefer KJ Costello? Yes. Do I understand why he would commit to play for Mike Leach? It makes sense. But also, this is Mike Leach not playing out against Pac-12 defenses. It's going to be different. Mike Leach has played his entire career as a head coach against the Big 12 and the Pac-12.
The Big 12 wasn't a pass-friendly league when Mike Leach got there. It became a pass-friendly league because Mike Leach was there.
Oh, God. Now you're defending Mike Leach out here?
I mean, as a football coach, he's a good football coach for the most part.
Which SEC are they in? The West or the East?
I would assume the West.
Are they in the Auburn-Alabama one?
I think they would put them in the LSU one.
The LSU-Georgia one?
I think Georgia would also be in the Alabama.
I'm just saying the level of competition that he's going to face in the SEC is different than the level of competition that he's going to face in the Pac-12. So KJ Costello can have fun in Mississippi.
Yeah, the hits that he might take if he doesn't get the ball out quick enough.
That is concerning. I don't disagree with that.
It's just going to be a different scenario. Like, Mike Leach...
Oh, no, Alabama and Arkansas are in the West, in Auburn. And Texas, yeah.
And so, Texas A&M.
Texas A&M, LSU, and the Mississippi schools.
Yikes. So, Alabama.
You want to be in the East, as it turns out.
And that's the one with Georgia?
Just Georgia.
So he's in the hard one?
Yes.
Have fun to you, good sir. I hope you have a great time at Mississippi State. I'm just saying... Mike Leach in Wazoo ain't the same as Mike Leach at Mississippi State.
All right, look, you know what sport is being played when those cherry blossoms are blossoming? That's softball. We're a softball school.
I was worried you were going to say basketball.
Yeah, it's like
definitely not.
Maybe.
May? What scenario would they be playing in May?
I don't know.
UW ranked atop the NFCA preseason poll the second time. In the last 3 years, the Huskies have been preseason number one. Also happened in 2018 when they reached the Women's College World Series Championship Series before losing. They will begin play this weekend, participating in the Buzz Classic, hosted by Georgia Tech. It's the Yellow Jackets. Buzz will also face UAB, Furman, and Ohio in that tournament.
We own Furman!
First-team All-American Gabby Plain becomes the clear ace for the Huskies with the departure of Taryn Alvelo. All-American Sis Bates at shortstop and Morgan Flores at catcher also return, and the Huskies add the nation's number one recruit, pitcher first baseman Kelly Lynch.
KJ Costello.
The other thing they have going for them, softball is returning to the Olympics this summer in Tokyo, and a handful of collegiate stars, including the ace pitcher Rachel Garcia and teammate Bubba Nichols from defending champion UCLA, are redshirting to be part of that national team. The Huskies did not have any players selected. Sis Bates was left off of that one. So her bad news for her, good news for the Huskies' chances in 2020.
It's kind of crazy that you can have players that just don't play. Yeah. Well, good for the Huskies.
So we look forward to following the softball team all year long.
UW softball. We're returning our damn essence to the damn fabric of the damn universe.
I don't know about that one. That might be a reach.
As UW owns.
You also don't know any of the context for that.
It's no context, the good place.
Well, that's true.
UW softball owns college softball. This is Sis Bates' season. Wow.
Is that me?
That was Bo Burnwell.
It was...
No, it wasn't.
message from Bill Barnwell.
An automated email.
That was Bill Barnwell.
UW women's basketball.
Are these games on TV?
Softball?
Yeah.
Probably not much during the non-conference. I think those are mostly streamed on places you have to pay to stream.
That's bullshit.
Yeah.
How many of these games are tickets available to you?
Aren't there like 12 Pac-12 channels? How can they not stream?
Well, once again, Pac-12 play, they'll probably be on Pac-12 network from time to time.
From time to time?
I mean, I don't recall specifically how frequently
this I'd rather watch UW softball
than I'd like to watch. There's important recaps of old football games that we need to be showing, or I don't know.
Like, would you rather watch UW softball or Sahonis?
Oh, don't bring it up to Sahonis.
Or UW basketball for the last 5 minutes of every game.
Oh, God. Well,
you could watch UW softball for an entire game, or UW basketball for the last 5 minutes of every game.
UW men's basketball for the first 30 minutes is the good place, and the last 10 minutes is definitely the bad place. but on the women's basketball front, suffered a 58-41 loss on Friday to number 6 Stanford, and then on Sunday went to overtime against Cal and lost 81-74. It's the third OT loss for the Huskies in their last four games, which is a common theme. Not necessarily overtime for the men, but a lot of close losses on both sides. After going scoreless against the Cardinal for the first time since her freshman season, Amber Melgoza bounced back with a season-high 35 against Cal. This weekend, amazingly, the Huskies do not play a single top 10 team as they host the Mountain Schools in their only meetings of the season with those two schools. Utah and Colorado, both 3-7 in conference play, so a chance for the Huskies to get some home wins this weekend. As for men's basketball, on Thursday, they led most of the way before losing 75-72 to Arizona with a late power outage, scoring just 3 points in the final 5.5 minutes of that game. Saturday versus Arizona straight, a slightly different script. They followed the other script they have, which is fall behind, furious comeback that falls just short in an 87-83 loss, dropping them to last place in the Pac-12 at 2-8. They have now lost 7 of their 8 conference games by 8 points or fewer and are somehow still +4 in point differential in conference play despite the 5-game losing streak because they beat USC by 32 and lost all these close games. According to Ken Pomeroy, asked him on Twitter, in the era he has stats for, the 2004 Florida Atlantic Owls have the worst record in conference play with a positive point differential, going in 6-14 while outscoring their opponents by 17 points. So probably the Huskies are going to do better than 2-8 is what I took from that.
I don't know about that.
I just signed up to receive an email about single game tickets going on sale for
softball.
UW softball. They actually go on sale tomorrow.
There you go. Probably want to go late in the schedule when it gets a little warmer on Montlake. So this weekend, the Huskies will play the Basketball Apple Cup against Wazoo on Sunday in Pullman at 3 p.m. The Cougs are having the anti-UW season. They have been outscored by 59 points in conference play, but have gone 4-6 thanks to a 2-point win versus Arizona State and an overtime win against UCLA. They have lost 3 times by at least 17 points.
Wow.
Despite that, new head coach Kyle Smith has Wazoo rated higher in KenPom than any point since January 2016. They are playing an analytically sound style, ranking 2nd in three-attempt percentage and 1st in holding opponents without three-point attempts. Smith's system was termed nerdball at USF, San Francisco, but he now prefers the, quote, data raid version of the air raid.
Love this.
It's that style is not really translating offensively, where they're 11th in offensive rating in conference play, but the defense has been competitive. They're ranked 9th there without any size. They're starting 6'6 wing CJ Ellaby as a power forward and 6'9 Jeff Pollard in the middle. Ellaby has predictably regressed from 3-point range after shooting 41% as a freshman, but is at 39% in conference play. Yeah. He's number 2 in the Pac-12 in usage rate, number 3 in defensive rebound rate, making just 31% of his twos, though, in conference play. So I guess that's why UW didn't recruit him coming out of Cleveland High School, a decision that was definitely a good one.
Sure.
So there you go. You look forward to not watching this game next Sunday, I take it, Tristan.
You watched neither of the games this week, Tristan?
I listened to the Arizona game. They sucked me in.
They did it again.
And then the same shit happened again. And I was like,
the thing is, it's always competitive at some point of the game.
and you always get this flicker of hope that maybe what happened with maybe only I get this flicker of hope.
No, I really thought they might. They might.
Oh, I was like, oh, we'll beat Arizona yeah. State. It'd be a great weekend.
Like, you think maybe what happened with Baylor will happen. Maybe they'll just, like, put it together for a few minutes and we'll end up on top.
How many games has Baylor lost?
Are they bad now?
No, they're very good.
Oh. But it just seems like Baylor, everything.
Yeah, that's still their only loss. They're 20-1. They've won 18 consecutive games.
Their only loss was to the games. University of yeah. Washington?
It was.
What are they ranked?
They're number three in KenPom. I don't know what they're ranked.
I think they're ranked number one.
It's kind of crazy what's going on.
Well, they passed Gonzaga in one poll, and I think they didn't in the other. I think they're 1-2. Something like that.
With Jaden.
Yeah, so Jaden didn't start again against Arizona State. Played 20 minutes off the bench, 6 points on 0-4 shooting, 3 turnovers, and that one.
I mean, does this affect his NBA?
At some point, you would think
prospects?
It would. I don't know. There was a lot of scouts there at the Arizona game, and it was like there was the most quintessential Jaden McDaniels sequence of the season, where he had this impressive dunk and then taunted and got a technical foul fifth of the season.
That cost him the game. There's so many times that Jaden's text cost him the game.
It's not great. Not great.
Right? Jason Hamilton is going through it. The amount of points the Huskies have lost by and the times that Jaden has gotten technical fouls, which I think the one at
Utah
was bullshit. This I didn't see, but you say it was a legit one.
Yeah.
A technical foul for blocking a shot that you hit somebody's head is different than taunting.
I mean,
yeah.
And it wasn't like a light taunting. It was like an aggressive light taunting.
Why? Dude, hit a fucking shot first.
Well, he did in this case.
A dunk is not a shot. Hit a jump shot.
I mean, we saw a lot of the good Jaden stuff. He had 5 assists in that one, 3 blocks, including a chase down. But then he also shot 5 of 13 from the field. So
he's going to be the G League MVP in 2 years.
It was kind of a rough night for Isaiah Stewart against the length of Zeke Nagy in the Arizona defense. He went 2 of 12 from two-point range, although he did step out and make a 3, so that was good to see for the scouts, I'm sure.
And they took away from it that he can't play against NBA-level height.
Maybe.
He's getting, like, doubled and...
There was one play in particular, though, where he was like one-on-one and just couldn't do anything against that length of Najee, who is also probably a first-round pick.
Well.
8 more games left.
Maybe we can beat Wazoo. I always thought in prior years the Wazoo week was the worst week because we didn't get 2 games. We only got one. And now it's like, oh, this is actually kind of nice. Yeah.
Let's wrap up with the Seahawks and pay attention to a couple of recent Russell Wilson comments, including one we didn't get to last week from ahead of the Pro Bowl. He was asked during an interview on ESPN if the team had, quote, the right pieces in place for 2020. Here's what he had to say. I think we need a couple more. I think Clowney is a big-time guy that we'd love to get back. He was so good in the locker room. He brought so many havoc plays on the field. Hopefully we can get a few other players there on the defense and also on offense. We have a great offense, but we can always add more pieces, and I think that's the part that's going to be great with John Schneider and Pete as well in terms of this offseason's free agency. Free agency is very, very key to get the superstars on your team and try to get great players who can fill the space. And then the draft. We always do a great job in the draft, and that's going to be really important to get the young stars up and coming.
I'm disoriented by the press speak. He said that free agency was a good place to get stars.
Yeah, he said superstars.
Superstars?
He's saying we need to go out and get somebody.
Basically, he's saying...
Signed Stephon Diggs.
Roster ain't good enough. I mean, he did focus on defense more than offense. We can always add a few more pieces on offense, but hopefully we can get a few other players there on the defense. So... That was interesting.
Doesn't care about comp picks.
And then, last week, on with Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk and Chris Sims asked why the Seahawks don't seem as effective early on offense as they are in the fourth quarter. Chris Sims went on an extended rant about like how it's always so stressful watching the Seahawks, which
been there. It's a lot stressful for us than it is for you, Chris Sims.
I'm sure it is. Here's what Russ had to say. He had some comments about basically how successful they've always been in the 2-minute drill, and then said, I really know what I want to get after them. how we want to get after them, especially in those moments. And guys just make plays in those moments. The freedom of just going after it and just scoring as many points. That's kind of what the Chiefs do, to be honest with you. They do a really good job, Andy Reid and Mahomes, of getting up to the ball, playing with their playmakers, and finding a way to make plays. They score more points than everyone else. That's the name of the game, is can you score more points than they do? There's different ways to go about it. Listen, the reality is that we've won a lot of football games over the years, but I also think there's also the expectation of being here, not just sitting here in this seat next to you guys, unfortunately, but being on the big banner and winning it all. We're going to try and figure that out and see if we can get back here quickly.
That scares me a little bit.
Does it? That excites me.
Who wins in that battle?
I mean, Russell is under contract for like 5 years. I don't think you're going to trade him.
No, I'm not worried about him being traded. I just mean, Russell has always seemed like he's just been like,
yes,
I'll do whatever Pete, you know, I am Pete. I'm emulating Pete. And now it seems like maybe he's saying, well, we need to change some things. Maybe Pete isn't, you know, God.
Russ is growing up. He's growing up before eyes. Now, I want to say that I actually...
He should really play the game first before he makes these comments.
What does he know about trying to pass to score points?
He's read Ben Baldwin's articles on The Athletic. He's maybe thinking that maybe we should fire Pete.
I mean, I read this, like, while watching the interview, like, Russell's not, like, fired up. He's not ranting here. He was just answering the question and doing so calmly, and he points out they've won a lot of games. But this is definitely the most, like, prodding we've ever seen from Russell Wilson, and that's interesting. Because it's one thing for, like, all the media to start doing it now, but for actual Russell Wilson to do it is another level that I think that demands the attention of Pete Carroll and John Schneider.
Do you think that last Super Bowl was not a good Super Bowl for passing the ball?
It was not. Turned out there was two really bad quarterbacks in it.
Offense in general. They'll both be played $30 million next year. Offense in general.
Maybe both in LA.
This one, it would be hard to take anything else away from it. I mean, then Pat Mahomes won this game, right? And what the Chiefs do, I mean, like, the Niners came into this game touted as the running team, right? And they lost the game. I mean, I guess if you wanted to galaxy brain, you'd be like, well, the Niners just didn't run the ball enough.
That's what Twitter was saying. The Twitter replies.
There was a lot
Tamina
of...
Tamina Kimes tweet. The Twitter replies to Tamina Kimes tweet.
So maybe that was it. But, like, there's definitely an element of, like, the idea that passing teams can't win Super Bowls has been refuted a little bit. At the same time, Kyle Shanahan ain't walking through that door. Sean McVay ain't walking through that door. I don't know if Pete Carroll and Brian Schottenheimer are capable of running an effective offense.
But it's still their offense in these fourth quarter situations. It's not, I mean, yes, there's more flexibility for Russ to call his own plays and that sort of thing, but he's not drawing up plays in the dirt out there. Not,
man, when the preseason game that Russ was the offensive coordinator or whatever was calling,
and they
plays,
went down, just that scored was, so quickly.
God,
what a moment!
If we could just have Russ OC or at least play caller plus quarterback, that'd be pretty cool.
I just don't know how it's gonna work. I don't see them changing that much.
I mean,
if Wilson,
I do think one thing that we probably don't talk about enough, and Ben has tweeted about this a little bit, is, you know, just the difference between, like, in 2018, the Seahawks were extreme in terms of never passing the ball on early downs. Last year, they were on the low end for the NFL, but they were not at a historic level. Now, that's partially because they just didn't run as effectively last season as they did in 2018. But
you have to be cheering for the run game to be bad.
You kind of do. But it does indicate, I don't think that, I think there's a little more malleability here than sometimes Pete Carroll is given.
It's just,
for.
It's not going to be
the Chiefs.
But it's not going to be the Chiefs' offense. Russell Wilson is a better quarterback than Pat Mahomes is.
Pat Mahomes is very good.
Saying fundamentally, like, you were watching that game yesterday and you're like, damn, Russ makes a lot of these throws.
That was definitely not Patrick Mahomes' best game.
But even then, it's like, what can Mahomes do that Russ can't do?
Some, like, sidearm throws.
Left-handed.
Yeah.
I don't know if you put them apples to apples in the same offense, if Mahomes is better than Russell Wilson. And it's like, Pat Mahomes is in the right offense, and he's an excellent quarterback, but like Russell Wilson has been in the wrong offense his entire career.
Except for the last 6 weeks of 2015.
And even then it was a very specific thing. But like, if you take that 49ers offense and you're like, okay, we'll just run the ball when you want, and then when you're going to give it to us, but pass the ball when you're going to give that to us and when we need to. Can you imagine just the difference ability-wise between Jimmy Garoppolo and Russell Wilson?
Come Garoppolo.
It's incredible, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's such a massive difference between those two offenses, and the Shanahan offense is able to get to the Super Bowl. But Russ is constantly being held back. I mean, you saw it today. I think it was the highest either QBR or EPA in the playoffs.
Highest QBR.
And it's just like,
ahead of Mahomes.
We are wasting constantly. This was... we're just wasting the best years. I just constantly, like, listening to these things, I'm like, oh, these are the NFL 100 or whatever, the top quarterbacks. And I'm like, Russell Wilson probably will never be in this category because he's not going to have the coaching that will let him do it.
I mean, also, NFL 100 is a pretty high bar. I'm not sure that Russell Wilson on pure, like, talent,
Steve
abilities.
Young, John Elway. Like, Russell Wilson is better than these quarterbacks. We just only have so many years to live, and Russ just has to be unleashed.
It's got real dark.
On that note.
After Kobe, we really have to think about how many years we have of Russell Wilson, and it's like, are you just going to fucking waste him? Like, what's the point of him handing the ball off to Chris Carson to fumble the ball? Really, what's the point?
It sets up incredible comebacks.
Great. Sometimes I just wish that I, like, would it be fun? We would hate this. We'd hate every second of it. But would it be a little bit fun to see Russ with Sean McVay or Kyle Shanahan, like with or Eric Bieniemy?
I think it would be interesting as a thought experiment, like one that doesn't actually exist in reality. I'd like to test out things that I think and see if they're actually true.
But it would be incredible, right?
You would think, but maybe, I don't know. Maybe it doesn't work. And
I've heard he's a system quarterback.
Who, Garoppolo?
No, Russell Wilson.
Huh.
Needs the running game to succeed.
Too short to work in the running game in San Francisco. Raheem Mostert, first round pick this last year.
That's why they drafted him.
It would just be kind of fun to be like, God, it's like Russ is ours, and we want him to be whatever is within the Seahawks system. But it's like, damn, it would be fun to see.
Of course.
What he could do with a real offense. You okay, Katie?
Yeah. It's just got really depressing.
It's really hard not to watch the Super Bowl and be
I
like...
I would have expected that to happen in the men's basketball section.
We watched the Super Bowl where I think both of these coaches put their quarterbacks in pretty good situations to win.
Yeah.
And one of them did it and one of them didn't. But like...
one of them took advantage of them and one of them didn't.
And even then, Russ played better against this Niners defense than Pat Mahomes did twice. Russ did it twice. He did it. He didn't do it on a neutral site. He did it in their house. And then he did it at home again. Right? Like, this was basically the same Niners defense. And Russ did it twice.
They were missing several players in the second game in particular. I think D Ford might have missed both games. I can't remember if D Ford was healthy for the Monday night game.
So it's like,
yeah,
this could be ours. Like this dynasty that people are talking about, the Chiefs, and the Chiefs, for whatever reason, are not losing their offensive coordinator after this.
Scholars are divided on what the explanation could be. That the best offense in the league that won the Super Bowl, their offensive coordinator didn't get a head coaching job.
Kevin Stefanski. But it's just like, the Chiefs are able to maintain this. They were the best team in the NFL last year, probably. And then they're the best team in the NFL this year. They win the Super Bowl this year. And then they can bring everybody back. And Mahomes is just put in these perfect situations. And you're like, why can't, when you had the quarterback, why don't you just build the whole infrastructure around the quarterback rather than just being like, well, we need to rein in what they're doing, right? And it's something that on defense, I don't think the Seahawks do. And I don't think the Pete Carroll offense or the Pete Carroll defense does, where it's like if you have a beautiful beast like Michael Bennett, like Richard Sherman or somebody, like you want them to excel and you give them every opportunity to excel in those opportunities.
But this is what they think is giving Russell Wilson the best opportunity to excel. That's the fundamental difference.
They're just dumb.
Dumb.
They're bad at evaluating their superstar quarterback. I mean, they're not, because he was for a point the highest paid player in the NFL.
Right.
Like it's not like
trading him to the Giants.
But they still have not. He has never been it's not even unleashed. He's never been fully utilized in his entire career. Maybe for a brief period of time. In 2014 or whatever.
15.
But it's like they've never fully run a good offense around Russell Wilson, and it is holding the Seahawks back every single year. They get as far as he's capable of taking them within these confines, but they're not.
I mean, I just don't like, we know all this already. We've talked about this already. I don't know what it needs to be said.
It's frustrating watching Mahomes do that and just being like, fuck, Russ could do this. I think he's the best quarterback in the NFL.
I heard you thought he was the 8th to 12th best quarterback in the NFL. I don't think he's the best quarterback in the NFL.
Who do you think is better than him? Mahomes?
I do.
I don't think Lamar Jackson is better than Russell Wilson.
If I had to win a playoff game, I would take Russell Wilson over Lamar Jackson at this stage.
Over two versus having won the Super Bowl? Yes, me too. Lamar Jackson has literally never won a playoff game. So.
Well, on that uplifting note.
Remember 1995? I got 5 on it.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Dear Diary. Today I fell in love with the caucus.
Can we talk about that? Did anybody make fun of you for actually writing Dear Diary in your diary?
Not a single person did. You were shocking. The only one. Very disappointing.
I just don't know anyone who actually does that in real life. Like, I maybe kept a diary or a journal for like a few months, and I never once wrote Dear Diary to it. Like, it's self, like...
It's very implied. Murder, She Wrote.
It's also like someone else is going to read this, which I like vaguely referenced in that thing about the idea of publishing it.
Clearly, I had the idea. Writing a diary is through word processing.
Like Doogie Howser, he thought he was a young guy.
Oh, I mean, I loved me some Doogie Howser. So, and that was my favorite part was the end. Absolutely. Yeah. There was one How I Met Your Mother episode where they did that at the end of the episode. It was terrific.
You're the only one here who liked that show.
I think I like the show.
Yeah, I got the DVDs for the first two seasons of the show from Tristan.
Did I give you the DVDs?
I borrowed them at one point, at the very least.
Oh.
Watched them on Christmas Eve. Watched the episode where Ted gets drunk and there's pineapple involved and decided to get drunk at Christmas Eve. And it ended up with me throwing up.
Wait, really?
Like most of my Christmas Eve, according to this podcast. You decided to get
drunk because of How I Met Your Mother? Yeah. Oh, Dear Diary.
Oh, no.
Today I watched How I Met Your Mother and decided to get drunk at Christmas Eve. I threw up in the end.
I was drunk enough that when I went back to my house, I thought that it would be a good idea to drink some eggnog at that point.
Oh man,
and that was not.
I remember, this was the year that I got the like liquor from like Thailand or whatever. From Chris and Reagan, and we were taking shots of it. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I don't remember.
It was
that,
like a sake type thing.
You know why I don't remember that.
I don't remember this either. I only remember the gun filled with tequila.
Oh, yeah, there was a tequila gun also.
That's the only, I don't remember any other special liquors.
All right, as usual, you're going to have to talk into the microphone. That's okay. The way it records.
Just before you say something, say Dear Diary.
Dear Diary. Oh, no. And then he can just turn up the volume. Just search for every Dear Diary and turn up the volume.
This was a mistake. I already regret this decision.
Oh, I need a computer to look up our friends at hiphopgoldenage.com.
Oh, I was trying to remember what that website was so I could find the top five songs, and I couldn't remember. It does not bode well for how much I'll remember about the year 1991.
Oh, no.
It's weirdly hard to remember.
It's just a very long website name.
Good friends at hiphopgoldenage.com.